It's widely known that the COVID-19 pandemic began in China. It's been called the China virus by the president and others. In March, the FBI warned that an increase in hate crimes against Asian Americans is underway. A national registry of anti-Asian hate crimes was started 3 weeks ago and now has over 1,400 entries. At least one of them is from here in Haleiwa. This isn't the first time an anti-Asian wave swept the country, according to author, journalist, activist Helen Zia. She lived through the last wave, and it's a fascinating American story. Zia grew up in the counterculture 60s, experiencing the anti-war movement, Black Power, the women's movement, and she wanted to learn more about America's strong labor movement of that time.
I went to get a job in the auto industry, which at the time was booming, and was part of the strongest benefits and wages that workers could get in America. Minimum wage at the time was $1.50 an hour, and I was getting $10 an hour plus every benefit you can imagine in Detroit. So this was a labor force.
Did you feel fully accepted as an Asian American?
People, of course, looked at me pretty, you know, one of the rare Asian Americans and Asian American women working in an auto factory. But on the other hand, growing up in New Jersey, where there were so few Asian Americans anyway, I was sort of used to that. And if I did my work, nobody cared. You know, yes, I had incidents of name-calling and stuff like that, but for the most part, you know, it was a community of minorities. I mean, 60 to 70% African American workforce. The rest were Southern Caucasians, whites, who had migrated up to the north as immigrants themselves, in a way, to go work in the auto plants for that high-paying money. And so I was just one of the Detroit area has the largest Arab-American population outside of the Middle East. So even though being Asian-American was pretty rare, it was a very multiracial workforce and community. So I was there, and this workforce was, you know, a very well-paid, hard-working bunch of people who pretty much got along most of the time. They had to work together. And then the auto industry collapsed because, you know, this may be ancient history to a lot of people, but there was a worldwide oil crisis at the time, and the cost of gas skyrocketed. Nobody could afford to drive the dinosaurs out of Detroit that got maybe 7 or 8 or 9 miles a gallon. So nobody was buying those cars anymore. And what they were going for, if they bought any cars at all, were Japanese imports that were fuel efficient or VW Beetles. And those were the only cars people could afford to drive anymore. And millions of people got laid off. I did too. The misery and despair of people who had once made pretty good livings and had a future so good that they wanted their kids and grandkids to work in those industries too, because they could afford a home, a second home, a summer cottage, recreational vehicles, in addition to the 2 or 3 cars they had. And then they lost everything, including their futures. And this depression in the Midwest went on for years.
When did you start really feeling it?
It started in about 1979, when the Iranian Revolution happened. The effects were immediate. I mean, the auto industry totally collapsed, and every supplier, every service, you know, the hotels, the restaurants, the people who service the auto industry, the other car parts, the tire makers, they all went out of business. Everybody was laid off. Nobody had a job. I would stand in unemployment lines that snaked way around many city blocks, and you'd wait there all day long, hoping to get to the front. And this was in the dead of a Michigan winter. It was terrible. And the blame game began very early on. First, the auto companies blamed the workers. The workers aimed the auto companies. They all blamed the politicians in Washington, and then they all agreed on an enemy, Japan. It was Japan's fault because Japan was able to make better cars than Americans. And so all of that hatred, despair, and misery and frustration suddenly turned to Japan, to the Japanese, and anybody who looked Japanese, which, you know, I was one of them. And anyone who drove even a Japanese make car, whether they were white, black, or any other color, they could get shot at on the freeways. I mean, that's how angry people were. And it didn't help that all of this anti-Japanese rhetoric also, of course, turned to war.
What rhetoric?
Well, the rhetoric about we are at war. I mean, it sounds very familiar today. We are at war. This is a war. This is an economic war. It's just like Pearl Harbor, which unfortunately the Surgeon General just invoked. And so what do we do when we're at war with Pearl Harbor? We kill them. We bomb the hell out of them. Lee Iacocca, who was the CEO of Chrysler at the time, said we should send back the Enola Gay. Let's send back atomic bombs. Bomb Japan. That was the rhetoric that came out every day. And for the ordinary worker on the street, people were taking sledgehammers to Japanese-made cars, shooting people who drove them.
You see parallels today?
There's no question about it. With all the, it's a Chinese virus, as though viruses know what race or ethnicity or country. All of that stuff has already sparked a strong racist reaction. I mean, very early on, even before there were any cases in the U.S., there was empty Chinatowns all over the U.S., even though these are Chinese Americans who had nothing to do with China. So that began, you know, way back in January.
Well, that happened in Honolulu, too.
But the constant fear-mongering of people from Asia, which has been stoked for a very, very long time, you know, well before this virus, has really exploded the amount of hate violence, harassment, hate language, bullying, kids being beaten up at school when schools were open.
Can you feel it on the street at home there in Oakland?
Oh, people are getting spit on, they're getting coughed on, and you don't know whether the person coughing on you actually has the virus. I mean, these are acts of violence, and I don't think we should minimize the use of language and hate. In Midland, Texas, an Asian family went to a Sam's Club, and some deranged guy took a knife and started stabbing them, including the 2-year-old and the 6-year-old. I don't know why that is not national news. And this is just the beginning. You know, I was in Detroit when Vincent Chin was killed. And he was not the only one. There were many other violent attacks. We're at the beginning now. When everybody starts knowing people who are sick or even dying or passed away, not only that, people are going to be massively, on a massive level, unemployed. And if this goes on for months and months, which we're being warned it may, the hatred and the frustration and the misery and the anger is going to be pouring out. And I don't want to be an alarmist, but I think people do need to be prepared. Asian Americans need to be forewarned, and we need to reach out to our friends, to other organizations, to get organized, to prepare for this pandemic of hate virus just as much as we're preparing for the other virus.
Look at the past. Helen, what is the best response for Asian and Pacific Islander Americans and anybody?
For one thing, it's to be informed. We ourselves, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, people who may be blamed because of our appearance, which is what racism is about, need to be aware that it's out there, not to be caught by surprise. I have many family members and friends in Hawaii, and I know that because there is a high population of Asian-looking people, as well as a multiracial, multicultural population, you know what? People in Hawaii are more used to getting along with people and not being so alert to a stare that might be racist and unfriendly. For me, growing up in New Jersey, I grew up with that. I can feel it. I can walk into a room and know it's there. And I think that's a level of awareness or immunity or body protection as well, just to know that this is out there. And second of all, to not be terrified, but to take precautions. And some of those precautions are to not go to places that might be dangerous and not, you know, in other words, where there might be people around who might not like you.
Like Sam's Club?
Yeah, but, you know, to not be surprised. In other words, I might go for a walk with friends, or if I'm going to go out alone, I'm going to start letting people know where I'm going and how long I think it'll take for me to get back. And I know this might seem so weird in a state like Hawaii, but beyond that, it's not just an individual thing, and I think that's the main thing we have to know. We have governments, we have communities, churches, organizations, nonprofit organizations that we can rely on, and if they're not aware of this whole situation that we are heading into and this other racist pandemic, we need to activate them and to reach out and be organized. And that is one of the things that came out of that whole period of anti-Asian racism in the 80s. New organizations formed. Asian Americans started reaching out to each other. You don't have to be Chinese or Japanese to experience this. We already know more than 1,000 reports of anti-Asian racism were made on these websites in the first 2 weeks, more than 1,000. More than 60% of those reports were non-Chinese, you know, people who look Chinese or just look Asian in a way that somebody wanted to direct their anger toward. We all need to raise our own awareness, help to educate other people in our communities about what's going on. Then we'll not only get through it, we can get through it stronger. And fight against racism toward any people, because when any people are subject to prejudice and hatred, that hurts everyone, and we have to remember that.
Writer, journalist, activist Helen Zia's latest book is Last Boat Out of Shanghai, the epic story of the Chinese who fled Mao's revolution.